This is Central Time. Now, when you think of black bears in Wisconsin, you might think that the species is relatively confined to the northern parts of the state, and while that may have been true in the past, things are starting to change.
The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says Wisconsin's occupied bear range is now expanding south, potentially bringing bears into contact with residents not used to dealing with them. In addition, black bear population numbers are up significantly from where they were just 3 decades ago.
Jeff Pritzel is with us now. He's a wildlife biologist and the Northeast District Wildlife Program Supervisor for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, you're welcome. Good afternoon.
Well, talk, Jeff, about what's going on here. Black bears are moving out of their traditional range. First of all, what do we think of as their traditional range in Wisconsin?
Well, yeah, I think when people think about black bears in Wisconsin, they think about that as an up north species. But when if you look at black bears in continental North America, they're all the way down in Louisiana along the Gulf Coast, down in the Southwest. So they're not obligate to being a northern species by any stretch. It's just a matter of where the habitat has been available for them in Wisconsin. And I think the expansion of the bear population is related primarily to changes, improvement in habitat, and available food sources.
And when we talk about the habitat, you talked about available food sources. What else are we talking about? Forests and isolation, that kind of thing?
Well, they are somewhat obligated to forested landscapes, but it doesn't have to be deep woods. Wherever there's that mix of forest and open lands, what creates good food sources, they have a vegetation diet than a meat diet during certain times of the year, so they're keying in on berries this time of the year, acorns, so those types of habitats that produce a lot of mast and that type of forage. And they also can take advantage of agricultural crops. They love field corn when it's in the milk stage. There's plenty of farmers in the state that have dealt with problems with black bears in their cornfields.
Can you talk about black bear sightings lately where, you know, the locals may not have expected to see a black bear?
Sure. Well, on my side of the state, I work out of Green Bay, and so we haven't seen as much of a southern expansion on the eastern side of Wisconsin as we have on the west. On the west half of the state, they've moved down into that driftless country all the way down to the southwest corner just because the habitat is a little bit more suitable. On my side of the state, I've been working in Green Bay now for 11 years, and I've watched, I guess what I would call the line of awareness move south over the last decade from Highway 64 down to Highway 29, and now it's even moving down towards Highway 10 near Appleton, where people have become aware of the fact that if I leave food sources out, whether it's garbage or my bird feeders, there's a chance I might attract a black bear. And so I can gauge that each spring by where the phone calls come in April and May when people call and say, hey, we've got a black bear. And that line used to be, again, north of Green Bay, and now it's south of Green Bay, closer to Appleton on my side of the state.
And now that we have bears moving into more southern areas, especially on the western side of the state, do they bring any problems with them, or is this something that residents just have to get used to?
Well, it's relative because, people in the northern half of the state that have lived with bears for a long time, just adjust how they manage their surroundings. It all focuses on food sources. And so we can live, cohabitate on the landscape with bears. We've done it for a long time. People up north do it, and it's really no big deal. But in the southern part of the state, a bear may still cause attention or be newsworthy, and it's just a matter of people thinking about, well, what do I have on my, outside of my residential area that may be attractive to a bear, whether it's a dirty, a grill that's got some good smells on it from the cooking, or a compost pile. Bird feeders tend to be the main attractant, and so people adjust their behavior as to when and how often they put and where they put their bird feeders. And just by making some of those adjustments, you can pretty much eliminate any causes of concern. And most of the issues we do have with black bears tend to be property damage, where they're knocking down something, trying to get at a food source.
What do we know about overall black bear population numbers here in the state?
Well, the population in the state actually peaked about 2010, and we had done some new research and surveys that gave us a better handle on what the bear population was, and we recognized that we were up upwards of over 30,000 animals. And at that time, back in 2010, we were also peaking with bear nuisance complaints. We were spending over $500,000 a year in dealing with, mitigating bear nuisance problems by moving animals and such. And so we adjusted our bear hunting strategy. We're in the middle of the bear hunting season right now this year, to increase permits and increase that annual harvest. And we've gradually brought that bear population down a little bit, actually, over the past 5 or 6 years very effectively. And now we're trying to find what's that good balance, that where we've got a good, vibrant bear population in the state, but not to the level where it's just causing excessive problems.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Good luck with the fundraiser.
Thanks. That's Jeff Pritzel, a wildlife biologist and the Northeast District Wildlife Program Supervisor for the Wisconsin DNR. He joined us to talk about the expanding range of black bears here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, the Department of Homeland Security said that Wisconsin was a target of hacking attempts during last year's election, but the state's election system itself may not have been the target. We'll get the details. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The Department of Homeland Security confirmed late last week that Wisconsin was one of 21 states that had its election systems targeted by Russian hackers during the 2016 election.
But today, the agency reversed course, stating that the Russians instead attempted to hack the State Department of Workforce Development. The course correction came today as the Elections Commission offered apologies to state residents.
Patrick Marley is with us now to tease out some of the confusion about the story. He's a state capitol reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, this got a little twisty-turny over the last few days, didn't it? What was the initial statement? What happened from the Department of Homeland Security?
So Homeland Security called 21 states on Friday to inform them that they were their election systems had hacking attempts from the Russians, or people working on behalf of the Russian government. Wisconsin previously believed that it was not one of the states. In June, Homeland Security had said there were 21 states. Wisconsin officials had said they had been contacting Homeland Security, and Homeland Security had said states that were affected had been contacted. So Wisconsin officials concluded that they had not been the target of these attacks. Then on Friday, got this call. Wisconsin officials made it public, and we learned which states were targeted here. Today, the Elections Commission met to talk about this, among other things, and in the course of the meeting, produced an email that had come from Homeland Security this morning, telling them that, in fact, the online voter registration system had not been the target of an attack, that instead the Russian hackers had attempted to get a system from the Department of Workforce Development.
So that's a little weird. I mean, we spent the weekend thinking that the election system, the registration system, had been the target of a foreign hacking attempt. Now they're saying Workforce Development, and that's puzzling as to why they would want that. What did Homeland Security give more information about that hacking attempt?
No, Homeland Security has not given any details about that. The Wisconsin election officials say that it's possible that what happened was that these Russian hackers had been scanning, or they use the term scanning, they've been trying to get into election systems in other states. The same computers were used to try to get into the Workforce Development, that it is possible that the hackers meant to get to our voting registration system and just hit the wrong target, hit Workforce Development instead of the Elections Commission. That's speculation. We don't know that's actually what happened, but that's one theory as to why they would go to try to get into Workforce Development, which is not, you know, the kind of agency you would expect foreign hackers to try to attack.
And one thing I think to make clear, people would be especially interested if voting machines themselves or vote counting machines had been targeted. From all of this and this back and forth, that has not been an apparent target of attacks. Is that correct?
That's right, and part of the reason there would be that those machines are not connected to the internet, so it would be a much different and much harder to do to get into vote tabulating machines or voting machines, because it appears that you'd have to go machine by machine to get into them.
So we've got this Wisconsin Elections Commission. This is still a fairly new thing, and what was their reaction to that initial announcement from Homeland Security? It would seem like something bad had happened on their watch and they didn't know about it from that initial announcement.
Right. So the meeting opened with the chairman of the Elections Commission, Mark Thompson, offering a public apology, saying, I wasn't informed of this until Friday. I should have asked tougher questions of Homeland Security in the past months. I'm sorry to the public that we didn't ferret this out sooner, and we're gonna keep asking Homeland Security about why we weren't informed until more recently. So it had turned out that after learning this information on Friday, the Wisconsin Elections Commission officials had immediately asked Homeland Security, you know, for more detail, and the people they had on the phone said, we can't provide you that information. You need to talk to somebody else at Homeland Security. So then there were a series of back and forth between the state and the federal government over, well, when did this happen? When did you alert anybody of this type of attack or attempted attack? And as Homeland Security provided more information, they said, well, this isn't even our computer system. And then during the course of the meeting this morning is when they got the email from Homeland Security that told them, oh, it turns out that the computers that were targeted by the Russian hackers weren't the systems for the elections.
Now, Patrick, I know you can't read the minds of people on this Elections Commission, but did you get the sense that there was some frustration with Homeland Security over the way this information is coming out and being changed?
Yeah, certainly from Mark Thompson, there was some frustration there. I think the commissioners are trying to hold back a little bit until they know more information because things are so unclear. One thing they're pleased about is that they thwarted any attack wherever it may have come from. The State Department of Administration is in charge of cybersecurity for the Elections Commission, and they had the chief information officer for the state testify at this hearing this morning, or not hearing, but at this public meeting this morning about what they knew, when they knew it, what they had done to try to stop any attacks. They feel that by the end of it all, all the officials said that they felt everybody was doing the right things, but were not doing a good job of communicating with one another. So that's clearly one of their top goals, is to have better interaction with the federal government in particular about potential threats and how to stop them.
Well, Patrick, thanks for untangling all this for us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
That's Patrick Marley, State Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the recent Department of Homeland Security announcement that Wisconsin's election registration system had been the target of Russian-backed hackers, and their subsequent reversal of that announcement, the clarification that it was a Department of Workforce Development computer that had been the target, apparently.
Coming up after the news, we'll talk about race, racism, and the murder of Emmett Till. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Emmett Till was 14 years old when he was abducted, tortured, and lynched in 1955 by two white men in Mississippi. Both were acquitted by an all-white jury.
Till's murder helped to spark the civil rights movement and national protest organizations developed in its aftermath. Till's murder is one of many instances of white supremacist violence that flared after the 1954 Supreme Court decision that declared school segregation unconstitutional.
And white supremacist ideals and sometimes violence are still an active force in American culture.
Timothy B. Tyson is a senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. His latest book is called The Blood of Emmett Till. Timothy will be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival on Thursday, September 28th at 5 p.m. at the Wisconsin Historical Society Auditorium. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Good. It's going to be good to be back in Central Time.
Well,
I love
nice.
Madison, Wisconsin, and honored to be with you on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Well, it's nice to have you here. And I want to ask you the subject of your new book, Emmett Till. This is a murder, a lynching from 1955. Why is it still such a searing memory today?
Well, I think Emmett Till's never really let us go. It's really the most notorious racial incident in the history of the world. In some ways, it happened just as TV had gone, national and international, and was when people commonly had it, and it was the first sort of TV media circuit. It really depended on it. A lot of this is because of Black Chicago, because Chicago was, African Americans had been coming to Chicago since the turn of the century. And had built the Chicago Defender, the largest circulation black newspaper in the country, and the the Johnson Publishing Company with Ebony and Jet, and the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and other black labor unions, and a large NAACP. Chicago is one of the is where much of the Great Migration landed. So and especially folks from Mississippi. And so Emmett Till, had he been from Mississippi, or even from some lesser place, we might not know it. But what his mother did, and he was really brutally murdered, and his corpse was a ghastly sight. And she had an open casket funeral, at which a couple hundred thousand Chicagoans came by to view the body. And that the photographs of that were published nationally. And then Black Chicago, which had the most powerful political machine in the country, had national connections, and the protest movement they built out of Chicago really created the infrastructure for a national civil rights movement. So that's one of the reasons why. And the tail sticks with us. So it also, you'll hear if you go to Black Lives Matter rally, you're very, very likely to hear people chanting Emmett Till's name. Mm-hmm. Michael Brown, Emmett Till, how many black kids will you kill? As the chant goes. And there are others.
I want to go back into Emmett Till's story and bring us up to present time in a bit, but you sat down with the white woman who'd accused Till of some kind of misconduct. It's unclear at the beginning of your book what this was, maybe a flirting with her, maybe more. She was in her 80s when you spoke to her. Why did she want to talk to you, and what did she say?
I think she... I knew that she had... never been interviewed since 1955, when she was 21. She had never said a public word about this. And I knew that journalists and historians had been trying to talk to her all that time. And she'd never given anyone an interview and sort of hid. And so, she called me up. Actually, her daughter-in-law called me up and said that her mother-in-law was coming to town and next week, and they'd like to have a cup of coffee with me. And I sort of pretended she hadn't said it, because she said, well, you might, she heard that in my voice and said, well, you might know about my mother-in-law. Her name was Carolyn Bryant. And of course, I knew all of that about her. And so I was happy to talk to her. I felt like I should. And I wasn't writing a book about her, but I got caught up in it, because it's a story that, won't let us loose and wouldn't let me loose.
And one of the things she told you was that one of the cornerstones of her testimony wasn't true.
Yeah, that was, I know that sounds like big news. Nobody believed her testimony anyway. So it never really struck me as such a, it wasn't like I was shocked, but I knew she was lying. It's, but that's that was what people seized upon with respect to the book. But to me, she wasn't really, to me, it wasn't anything like the most important thing that I learned in the course of researching and writing this book.
I want to look a little bit at the present and how that has been informed by the past. Now, if you think of Dylann Roof shooting 9 parishioners at a black church, if you think of an African-American man named James Byrd Jr. dragged behind a pickup truck to his death in Texas, do you see this violence as the continuing story of Emmett Till's death, of white supremacist violence?
Well, absolutely. White supremacy is the notion that God has created us in a hierarchy of moral, cultural, intellectual worth on the basis of pigmentation, with light-skinned people at the top and black, dark-skinned people at the bottom. It's a foundational notion for our country and much of the world, which is all it is. It's a lasting legacy of the Atlantic slave trade, but a rationale for it. But that. There's the violence, which is, it's an ongoing thing. America American history as a river of unpunished blood, but with respect to African Americans. But I think the striking thing is that, you know, it's not so much the racial brutality, the ongoing violent injustice, which we have had with us a long time, but what people did with it, it seems to me, is what matters. So I think of it as being the thing that is most important to me about the Emmett Till story, is what African Americans and other Americans who were committed to racial equality and justice did with that horrific story. They trumpeted it across the world. They marshaled all leveraged all the political strength of Black Chicago, and then organized a protest movement that went on for more than a year, coast to coast, and the labor unions and the NAACP and the churches and other progressive organizations that did that. That's how we had a national civil rights movement. This was a kind of convening of a national civil rights movement for the first time. And at that point, the civil rights movement, what we think of as the civil rights movement, was really a bunch of local movements across the South and loosely connected to each other to some degree. But the thing that we think of when we, you know, the thing that won the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and that brought at least, you know, nominally and full formal and legal equality before the law for African Americans, that movement really began with the lynching of Emmett Till.
And you mentioned, so it's not just, you wrote
it's
about
not just
how
a crucifixion
Rosa...
story, you know, it's a resurrection story in many ways.
You wrote about how Rosa Parks had been thinking of Emmett Till when she was at the bus on that day, thinking about not getting up. And I wonder if you could put that into words. What was it about Emmett Till's murder that sparked not just outrage, not just sorrow, but this concentrated, coordinated effort that spanned years and a nation and many, many organizations?
Yeah, well, the Mississippi... what I call the Mississippi Underground, the network of African-American activists in Mississippi who were involved in the Emmett Till trial, who found all the witnesses for the prosecution. Those people, people like Medgar Evers and Dr. T.R.M. Howard and Amzi Moore, they went around the country speaking, and Dr. Howard spoke at Dexter Baptist Church in Montgomery, invited there by an unknown fellow named Martin Luther King, and Rosa Parks was in the congregation, and he told that, you know, it was a very intimate story for him. He was, and he told that story, and then he and Rosa Parks and perhaps others sat up half the night talking about movement politics, and 4 days later she was asked to move to the back of a bus, and said later that I thought about Emmett Till and I couldn't move. So that was, you know, and that helped. And also what's less well known is that the money that there was money, a lot of civil rights money was raised in these coast-to-coast protests against the lynching of Emmett Till. And one of the first things they did was to buy a fleet of station wagons for the Montgomery bus boycott. Some of the early money that supported the Montgomery bus boycott came out of this case.
The echoes of Emmett Till run deep still today. Well, Timothy, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to talk with you and look forward to being back in Madison on Thursday.
It's Timothy B. Tyson, Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. His latest book is called The Blood of Emmett Till, and he'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival on Thursday, September 28th at 5 p.m. at the Wisconsin Historical Society Auditorium.
Coming up, we'll find out why Republicans in the Senate decided to drop their most recent effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare.